Hello and welcome to Sparks. Every Monday and Tuesday, it's the technical programme of news and features from Radiofax. And this week, an interview with Jodie Scott of Radio Luxembourg and Caroline fame. Hi-fi to the extreme. If tweaking fails, rebuild the house. The Roland Space Sound Synthesizer. The new novice licenses for radio amateurs in the UK. The latest JICRA figures for radio listening. A feature on Betacam cameras. And of course, your letters.
In The Independent, Adam Labore meets hi-fi fanatics who obsessively seek the perfect sound of music. When tweaking fails, just rebuild the house. For an architect, it was a simple problem. Alistair Horton's Roxanne Xerxes turntable, resting on bare wood floorboards, produced a mushy sound. The tiny vibrations in the flexible surface distorted the notes when he played a record. An average music buff might have bought a new turntable stand. An audiophile, a cross between a DIY freak and a fanatic about music, would not. Alistair ripped up the floorboards under his turntable to discover a 3-foot gap between them and the concrete foundations. He cut a plywood mould to the depth of the space and filled it with concrete, covering the floor joists for good measure. Once the concrete had dried, he put the floorboards back and set up his turntable directly over the concrete block. The Roxanne was now rock solid, and the music sounded almost perfect. Most people fit their hi-fi around their houses, but the true audiophile will rebuild his house around his hi-fi, like the Japanese designer who built a loudspeaker and house combined, with the diaphragm in the attic and the living space doubling as the speaker chamber. And only an audiophile would pay £785 for a Roxanne Xerxes turntable, plus extra for the recommended pickup arm, Artemis, £669, and cartridge, Shiraz, at £735. People spend £10,000 on a sports car, but what's the point when there is a speed limit of 70 miles an hour, says Alistair, a dub and hip-hop fan. I really enjoy listening to music, so it's worth it to me. I used to live in a DHSS building with a concrete floor where it sounded much better. You have to learn to use your ears. Once you've trained them, you pick up much more. But never enough to reach audio nirvana, known as an OOBE, out-of-box speaker experience, when the music is so lifelike it transcends the system upon which it is played. For the first article of audiophile faith is that once he, it's nearly always a he, has embarked upon the quest for the ultimate musical reproduction, he knows that the nearer he gets, the farther away he gets. There is always one more tweak, hi-fi speak, for improvement that will make the bass boomier, the treble clearer, or Mozart more moving. This may include something as simple as gold-pinned plugs for better conduction of electricity from the mains to the equipment, or inserting small plastic bubbles between the record and turntable for greater acoustic accuracy. Speakers, for example, must never be placed flat on bookshelves. They should be mounted on stands with four sharp spikes to hold them rigid on the floor. Ideally, they should include built-in spirit levels. The main thing is to forget about the music and keep adding and subtracting accessories. King of the tweaks is Pete Belt of Leeds-based PWB Engineering. Hailed as a visionary of oral new science, you can't prove it sounds any different, but that doesn't mean it doesn't work, by some, dismissed as a crank by others. He offers an eclectic array of hi-fi accessories. These range from Spira tube strips, £10 to £20 a metre, to be wrapped around cables and power supply connectors, to the Rainbow Quantum system. A home visit from a hi-fi dealer with a Rainbow Quantum system costs about £150. The dealer zaps the man-made object with a special gun to neutralise adverse electrical fields from the AC mains. There are, in fact, dangerous similarities between audiophilia and train spotting. The more specific end of the hi-fi press is packed full of techno waffle, with equipment reviews detailing esoteric electronic data, and the manufacturer's brochures often read more like manuals for military equipment than machines for playing music. The contoured groove in the top plinth of the Roxanne Xerxes turntable, for example, was calculated by a finite element computer program, the publicity material explains. The platters sit on a hardened tool bit spindle. The platters are ground to tolerances of commonly 25 millionths of an inch, with spindles individually matched to the bearing housings. Audiophiles sneer at Japanese stacking systems with flashing lights and graphic equalizers. At CDs too, they stick to old-fashioned black vinyl, dismissing their upstart rivals as producing a thin, overbright sound. British Hi-Fi is available in any colour you like, as long as it's black. Its design is minimalist. Tone controls, push-button record speed changes are usually outlawed. To change from 33 RPM to 45 RPM on the Riga planar turntable, for example, you have to lift off the glass platter and flip the rubber drive belt onto a different notch. It is a successful formula. The industry is worth £200 million a year, half of which is exported. Hi-Fi is still quite a male preserve. It's still got that boy's own feel of physics and soldering irons, says High Fidelity's Elizabeth Hughes, the only woman editor of a Hi-Fi magazine. One definition of an audiophile is that the equipment is more important than the sound. But endless tweaks do make a difference to the music, she says. A dedicated mains spur for your system will cost about £200. It involves an electrician wiring in a separate power supply direct to your hi-fi, cutting out the fridge, vacuum cleaner, television, and so on. It seems weird, but it does work. You do get a noticeable difference in sound. Jazz photographer Alan Titmus, 43, is a keen fan of Stax headphones, which is why he paid £475 for a pair of their Lambda signatures to listen to records on the £10,000 system he has built up over 20 years. He then laid out another £895 for an SRMTI dedicated valve energizer to drive the headphones, plus a further £475 for a spare pair of Lambda signatures for when guests drop in. Much as he loves his headphones, he still leaves the loudspeakers playing so he can feel as well as hear the music. The headphones are so light that the detail is phenomenal, he says. The key difference is that you are engaged by the sound as well as the music. I have had a few raised eyebrows on occasion, but I don't go around saying, come and listen to my hi-fi, it costs £10,000. Anyway, it's money well spent. I get so much pleasure from listening to music in that much detail, there is a genuine high. At the Cornflake shop in London's West End, Britain's trendiest hi-fi dealers, co-founder Chris Storch, admits some of his customers are a little eccentric. Like the man who bought a £3,000 turntable, but only owned one record to play on it, the soundtrack to the film The Terminator. Listening to familiar records on one of the shop's demonstration systems, it was easy to see how the audiophile's path is a slippery, seductive slope. Played on proper equipment, they really do sound like you are hearing them for the first time. The musician's breathing, the timbre of their voice, and the vibrancy of the instruments all seem to come truly alive. The equipment is expensive, but it's often guaranteed for life. And when, like Alan Titmus, you spend more than 40 hours a week playing music, spending several thousand pounds on a hi-fi starts to seem a dangerously reasonable idea. That article from The Independent. So, Andy, I think we obviously need a dedicated mains spur for the Radiofax transmitter. In fact, we already have one. The problem is, it's about 4 miles long and rather prone to being blown down by gales.
Well, my studio has its own spur as well.
My imagination, to think of good reasons, to keep on keeping on.
Keep on keeping on.
Got to make the best of,
best of, best of
a bad situation.
Bad situation.
Ever since that day,
ever
I woke
since
up
that
down.
Gone, gone,
you're considering buying one of the Philips DC777 shortwave car radios from Radiofax Sales, here's some very good news for you. After some hard bargaining with our suppliers, we're now able to offer these terrific shortwave car radios at the new lower price of only £239. And remember, not only is the DC777 a good quality digital readout shortwave tuner, it also has long wave, medium wave, FM stereo, a high quality stereo cassette deck and powerful stereo amplifier, all in a compact, standard size in-car unit. Shortwave coverage is from 3170 to 21910 kHz continuous. This unit receives a good review in the World Radio and TV Handbook and 4 stars in the Radio Netherland receiver shopping list. The new low price, remember, is only £239, inclusive of VAT and delivery in the UK or overseas airmail to anywhere in the world. There's no long wait for your unit to arrive. We hold them in stock. Contact our sales office for more information and a brochure. Telephone number is in England, 0483 275 997. Fax number is also in England, 0483 276 477. Or write to us at Radio Fax, The Forge, Cranley, GU6 7BG in England.
It's Radio Fax on 6205 and 12255. Fresh programmes start on Monday, Wednesday, Friday and Sunday. Our address is Sparks, Radio Fax, The Forge, Cranley, England, GU6 7BG. We'd love to hear from you. Write and let me know what you do and where you live, stuff like that. If you'd like a reply to your letter, which includes a station card, technical information, and an artist's impression of the transmitter site, please send 50 pence, 3 international reply coupons, or $1. Here's a letter from Christian Sen, who actually lives in Oberalm in West Germany. However, he was holidaying in Torbay, Devon. He writes, "I've heard your programme from Torbay. Your programme is very good. There's very good music." He listens on a Sony ICF 7600DS. He's 16 years old. Heavy suitcase to carry to Torbay, but it's worth it, I think. Listen to Radio Fax.
And now, the regional forecast. Radio Waves by Paul Donovan in the Sunday Times. Should a Cockney read the 6 o'clock news on Radio 4? Would it encourage the millions of people who never listen to the radio to switch on? Or, despite the frequent appearances of a Cornish defence correspondent, Mark Leighty, and a Scotsman, James Nocte, are there some accents which simply cannot convey gravity, reliability, and authority? 300 people who work in British radio descended on Birmingham recently to discuss such tricky questions over the 2 days of deliberation and dissent that form the annual radio festival. This sound equivalent of the Edinburgh Television Festival is the one forum where all sides in radio can meet, as well as make plans and forge alliances in the bars afterwards, as at any other convention. This year's festival, however, was unique. It was the last to be held under the present system. By the time next July's forum comes around, national commercial radio, something Britain has never had, will have been on the air for 2 months. Just like the arrival of any new baby in any family, it will make a lot of noise and things will never be quite the same again. This uncertainty about the future, a combination of excitement and trepidation, now dominates the whole of radio. BBC Radio, via its top-level network radio strategy group, is taking the most radical look at itself since it began in the 1920s. Nothing, absolutely nothing, is sacrosanct, said David Hatch, managing director of BBC Radio, in a keynote speech on the first day. Meanwhile, those in independent local radio fear their whole existence might come unstuck if next year's national commercial radio poaches all the advertising and sponsorship revenue. Everywhere there are shredded nerves, a feeling of radio at the crossroads. This was apparent on the first morning, when Robert Kennedy pulled out of the festival. He is one of the founders of Showtime Radio, the Easy Listening Consortium, which earlier this year won the license for Britain's first national commercial radio station, amid much publicity. Due to outline his plans, he withdrew after receiving legal advice that it would be imprudent to make public comments while attempting to raise £15 million on the money markets, which he has to do by the end of August, or risk losing the license. Peter Baldwin, the retired Major General who is the chief executive of the Radio Authority, pointed out that Showtime had so far only been offered the license and not yet actually awarded it. If Showtime fails to raise the necessary capital, the license goes to the next highest bidder, Classic FM, a light classical station backed by Robin Ray and Kiri Takanawa. Uncertainty does not necessarily mean passion, and there was something of a lack of that at the festival, until an outstanding talk by Beverly Anderson, the former teacher and broadcaster who was born in Jamaica. She argued forcefully that British radio, particularly national radio, did not reflect the contemporary vividness and variety of British life. The same few people, and she singled out Chris Searle, were used over and over again. This meant other voices and other attitudes were squeezed out. It's all so boring, she said. Not enough women, not enough regional accents. Radio was a cosy, exclusive, elitist boat. And if it was really serious about attracting the millions who don't listen, it should become more representative and accessible. And this is what brought us to the Cockneys. Doesn't the news belong to the Cockneys? Asked Anderson. If it does, they should read the news too. Her proposal divided the audience. The freelancers and youngsters agreed, and the decision makers tended to disagree. Jenny Abramsky, editor of BBC Radio News and Current Affairs, said the main criterion was whether people could read the news well, but she drew back from embracing Cockney accents. Elizabeth Smith, editor of the BBC World Service in English, said that people tend to associate quality with particular voices, even unconsciously, and broadcasters would be foolish to ignore these realities of life. Francis Lyne, controller of Radio 2, and employer of the most famous Cockney of all, Derek Jameson, made the most telling point, which was that when she organised a special event in which all the presenters throughout the day were female, to mark International Women's Day, she was inundated with complaints from females. It was resented by the women in the audience, she said, and particularly by the older women. Amid all the swirling speculation about radio's future, it was good to hear David Hatch stress that the Reithian principles of public service broadcasting must remain the foundation of BBC Radio, whatever shape it turns into. In practical terms, although he did not spell this out, it means that if, for example, Radio 5 is dissolved, its children's and educational programmes are not lost, merely put somewhere else. All of us who care about radio will be watching like hawks to make sure the BBC does indeed keep faith with the listeners in this way, and that its public service ethic is not going to be diluted, however bold and radical the changes that are likely over the next year. That piece by Paul Donovan from the Sunday Times.
From RadioFax, now part of a meeting report of the Audio Engineering Society, the Roland Sound Space Synthesizer. Spatial enhancement systems for stereo sound are undergoing a period of renewed interest at the moment because of the introduction of products such as Roland Sound Space. recently featured on BBC Television's Tomorrow's World. RSS is a four-channel binaural synthesizer, followed by a transaural processor, which attempts to place monaural sources at any angle of elevation and azimuth, that's position around the head, and then to process the binaural signal such that it becomes suitable for reproduction over loudspeakers. A mono signal is placed in sound space by splitting it two ways and then equalizing and delaying the two channels, so as to emulate the perceived characteristics of a real sound source in the chosen position, taking into account head diffraction effects and pinna transforms. The pinna is the bottom blobby part of the ear. The transaural processor then takes the binaural signal and introduces a crossfeed between the channels, tailored to cancel the expected crosstalk which will result from each loudspeaker to the opposite ear, left loudspeaker to right ear, and vice versa. The anticipated result, if the listener sits in the middle, is that the left ear only receives the left channel signal and the right ear the right channel, as with headphone listening. George explained that Roland saw the RSS device principally as another effects unit, designed to act as a tool in the mixdown and post-production process. He was not claiming that RSS was the future of stereo, nor that it produced full surround sound from two loudspeakers, although many listeners successfully perceived sounds from behind and to the sides of them. Listeners commented on the need to sit in the centre of the listening area, within about a foot, to hear the effect, and discussion ranged widely on the advisability and acceptability of this. Questions were also raised concerning the mono compatibility of the RSS processed signal, and George pointed out that at no time did the channels become completely out of phase, although clearly the system did affect the phase responses between the channels. On headphones, RSS material does not have the same surround effect as on loudspeakers, although the device can be switched to bypass the transaural processor, producing a straightforward binaural signal. Discussions also proceeded on the advisability of producing headphone mixes and loudspeaker mixes of albums, a question for the listener to ponder, written by Francis Rumsey.
here's a piece from BBC World Service, and it's about new licences for novices for amateur radio in Great Britain.
You have to use a receiver, transmitter. You have to use an aerial. Use Morse keys, microphones. That's just the bare essentials, really. You can get meters saying how strong your signal is and things like that.
How far can you reach?
Well, you can go all the way around the world. You've got to get the time right, so that you've got to be up at the right time. You might end up getting up at 3 o'clock in the morning to speak to them, but it's just possible.
The scheme to train young people in amateur radio was launched earlier this year by the Department of Trade and Industry's Radio Communications Agency when they offered free licences to those under 21 years old. The Minister for the DTI, John Redwood, was there to award the new licences. So why does the British government want to promote amateur radio to young people?
We want to see full use made of the radio spectrum in the United Kingdom. We're also keen to see young people taking an interest and maybe going on to greater heights in terms of radio technology and radio understanding. We need good scientists. This is a way of encouraging their enthusiasm.
What do you feel that amateur radio has to give to international communication?
It has a lot to offer because it gets people in touch at different ends of the world. It also means that the radio operators learn Morse, which is a means of communicating internationally without the language barrier. So it doesn't matter if you get in touch with somebody as far away as Thailand or Japan, you can still talk to them, even if they only speak their own native language and you only speak English, because you both know Morse code.
Hello, hello, Mayday. Are you still there? Mayday, come in, Mayday.
Hello, is that you? This is Mayday.
Oh, thank heavens, you're still alive.
Now listen, this might be my last chance of speaking to you.
You can depend upon me, I won't let you down this time.
Here is my position. Longitude 10 degrees, 33 minutes west. Latitude 5 degrees.
Are you on fire? What? Oh, hey, it's my bells.
Tony Hancock had a disastrous time in his ham radio days, but with the help of the Radio Society of Great Britain, the new novice licence holders won't have the same problems. David Evans is the secretary of the Radio Society who set up the training for the licences.
First of all, they need to know how to find a clear frequency to put their calls out on, how to make their transmitter go onto that clear frequency, how to put out an initial call, to be able to recognise the call signs that they hear coming back to them, to know where these call signs are from. They learn all the practical things that they've got to know to actually go on the air, know the rules of the airwaves.
Ham radio has been going for a long time. Is it now, because of the increase in communication, a dying hobby?
No, I mean, the magic of amateur radio is actually soldering the components together yourself, putting up an aerial, and then perhaps tapping out your message on Morse code and hearing that signal from Australia coming back. For example, in a few days' time, a friend of mine is on holiday in Nepal. He hopefully will be able to get on the air. He's made some prior arrangements. And many English amateurs hope to contact him. Now, Nepal, for example, is a very rare country. And there will be literally thousands and thousands of stations wanting to contact him in the few hours that he will be on the air. The skill and the fun and the challenge is actually getting through with all the other competition, if you like.
CQ, 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 6 meters. This is 2E0, Alpha, 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 calling CQ and standing by.
Hello, Hugh, can you hear me, mate? Yeah, just a second, a minute, over. You know, I don't think my aerial's long enough. That must be the problem. Hugh McNeil there, 13-year-old international amateur radio broadcaster, who I've absolutely no doubt at all will be presenting Megamix in a couple of years' time.
Well, that was from the programme called Megamix on BBC World Service. And a bit earlier you heard the calm and reassuring tones of ex-airline pilot David Evans from the RSGB. And did you notice the statement from John Redwood, the minister from the DTI, that they would like to see full use of the radio spectrum in the UK? Well, a lot of people seem to think that what we're doing is a very good use for 9 kilohertz of it.
That's a welcome change from the "there are no frequencies available" line that we normally get from the DTI. On to hello to BRT International. That's the voice of the Flemish community in Belgium. Stephen Windross has sent us one of his information sheets. Brussels calling, PO Box 26, 1000 Brussels in Belgium. So hello, it's Sparks from Radio Fax.
Music and Media reports the latest JITCRA radio audience survey figures for radio listening in Great Britain. UK independent radio has increased its audience share to 36.4% in the April to June survey. And although all radio listening fell back 3% from the record levels in the first quarter of 1991, boosted by the Gulf War factor, independent radio listening fell only 1%, and its reach increased slightly to 53%. With a record weekly audience of 22.7 million, independent radio listening is now 12.6% higher than a year ago. The expansion in independent services has been reflected in increased audience levels. The figures are independent radio 36.4%, radio 1 24%, radio 2 13.7%, radio 3 1.6%, radio 4 10%, radio 5 1%,
BBC Local Radio 8%, and other stations 5.3%. Radio 4 and Radio 3 registered the steepest declines. Radio 1 was the only BBC network to show a gain, helped by the introduction of its 24-hour service, and a noticeable increase in weekend listening. The station now attracts 6.8 million listeners daily. Capital Radio continues to dominate the highly competitive London radio market, despite increases in reach by KISS, Melody and Jazz. Capital FM holds the largest audience share of the London market at nearly 16%, ahead of BBC Radio 2 at 14% and Radio 1 with 13%. Capital Gold on AM has 9% share. Independent radio listening was up, with Beacon, GWR, Radio 4th and Cool FM achieving the largest increases in figures. However, there were some falls, with Clyde, County Sound, Invicta FM, Essex, Mid Anglia, Devonair, Plymouth Sound and Mercury all falling in reach by 4% or more. And just to finish, let's pick out a couple of incremental stations from the table here. First, there's KCBC, which is ex-Caroline Crispin St John or Howard Rose's station in Kettering and Corby, with a 23% reach, while Mellow 1557, transmitting from Clacton and using studios in Frinton-on-Sea of one-time laser owner Ray Anderson, East Anglia Productions, the whole station now owned these days by Invicta from Kent, at 11%.
Available now, a brand new Radio Caroline CD called The Legend Lives On. The CD contains 44 tracks taking you through some of the great events of Radio Caroline from the first broadcasts in 1964 with Simon D. Test transmissions from Caroline North with Daffy Don Allen. Tony Prince in 1966. Other great names like Robbie Dale, Crispian St. John, Andy Archer and Peter Chicago. One track features the female DJs through the 80s and you'll hear too. Memorable Caroline commercials and jingles, and about the collapse of the highest shipborne aerial mast anywhere in the world in 1987, plus shortwave test transmissions in 89 and the raid in that year on the Ross Revenge. All this is just a tiny fraction of what you'll hear on The Legend Lives On, a new 44-track CD available at £9.99 inclusive, only from these sources. SMC, PO Box 53121 at 1007 RC Amsterdam in the Netherlands, and from Chris Edwards, PO Box 1514, London W72LL in England. Radio Caroline, the legend lives on.
Yeah.
Next, we've got two items from Media Network on Radio Netherlands. The first one is about a station in the 6 meg band.
Listeners to 6211 kHz shortwave were treated to a tremendous signal for well over an hour. The music choice included a lot of French language selections. And then, around 16:30 UTC, the operator clearly decided it was time for dinner. And it was gone without any announcement. Direction finding seems to indicate the source of the signal was near Antwerp, Belgium. And it may have been the return of the occasional pirate calling itself the Voice of Love. It's been around for about 2 years, but clearly doesn't want people to contact it because when they used to identify on the air, they never mentioned an address. Seems a bit pointless.
Yes, indeed. And the next item is a short piece of an interview with Jodie Scott, a Canadian presenter with Radio Luxembourg, who is ex-Radio Caroline.
Finally, on a personal note, what attracted you to go and work for Radio Luxembourg, or, coming from North America?
They offered me a job. That was the thing. Before that, I had been on Radio Caroline, and obviously not getting paid, etc., etc. And so here was a chance to do it for real and get paid money and be able to live in a place that had heat and various pleasant things like that. And also because I like the internationality of it. I like the fact that you're communicating to such a wide variety of people who've got in common one thing, and that's listening to music that they like.
And in terms of choosing the music that you play on Radio Luxembourg, I mean, is it lucky dip? Is it lucky guess by the person who's sitting behind the microphone, or is in fact there is a computer system?
Well, who knows what the future will hold, but for the way it's been for quite some time, we do have the top 40, and then we have another 40 records that are in our playlist. From that, perhaps 50% will be chosen from that, but you can play anything you want. For example, I really detest Stock Aitken and Waterman music, and I really hate rap music, so I don't play any of those records. I'll play the Happy Mondays out of the chart. We can also, obviously, play any gold that we want to. It's completely free choice, play album tracks, but that said, you can also, if you have gotten over a piece of gossip that day that had something to do with garden gnomes, you could immediately run into the library and get The Laughing Gnome by David Bowie and put it on right afterwards. So you can make real snap decisions like that, which is freedom that most people don't have in radio.
Ex-Radio Caroline presenter Jodie Scott, who's now on Radio Luxembourg, interviewed there by Jonathan Marks on Radio Netherlands Media Network.
Sideshow, heat show, stereo hero, we can be still here. legacy of romance from a twilight world, the diary of a relative mystery girl.
Papa, not an admiration. Ready
David Meller charts the rise of the Betacam SP video format, which offers broadcast quality in a portable package, from Audio Media magazine. Do you remember what television news programmes were like 10 years ago? If your recollection is that they were pretty similar to what we have today, then perhaps the slow, steady march of technology has fooled your brain cells ever so slightly. Think hard, and you'll recall that the newsreaders, or newscasters if you are a News at 10 devotee, used to spend a lot more time on camera than they do now. These days, it's hard to catch a glimpse of the latest hairstyles and gaudy ties between film reports from far-flung corners of the globe. Actually, film is the wrong word to use here, because it was in the old days of television news, not really so long ago, that 16mm film was the news gatherer's medium, of necessity rather than choice. Film cameras have the advantage of being highly portable, but film needs to be processed to be viewable at all. It then has to be edited by physically cutting the film before being converted via a telecine machine into a transmittable video image. The result was that, in the main, news was delivered to us by the medium of the spoken word, and we had to believe what we were being told. During the course of the 1980s, most of us probably didn't notice that we were gradually receiving more and more of our news information in the form of pictures, from wherever the news was happening, sometimes live, sometimes very soon after the event. Occasionally we were treated to a particularly important news item with amateurish camera work and poor picture quality, but we could still see what was happening for ourselves, rather than have to take someone else's word for it. The driving force behind this improvement in access to information about what was happening in the world was tersely known as ENG, or more formally, as electronic news gathering. In essence, this meant the replacement of film cameras by portable video equipment, which could offer a greater diversity of news with a much better speed of delivery. Acceptance of this new technology took a little time. But now, news acquisition with electronic cameras is the rule, film now being something of a rarity. Backtracking a little, we ought to examine the role of film in more detail to see better the benefits provided by ENG. Simple 16mm film cameras are relatively inexpensive, and a lot of important events have been captured for posterity in this way. There is, for instance, a good deal of footage of the Hungarian uprising of the 1950s, which is comparable in every way to the more recent events in Tiananmen Square, China, but without the omnipresence of Kate Adey, of course. Film cameras of the period could be very simple, and almost pocketable in size, particularly those which used spring-driven motors and were fully self-contained, requiring only the film stock and enough light to shoot in. But such cameras could only capture pictures. To record synchronized sound, to enable a reporter to perform the now familiar talk to camera, which provides the important element of on-the-spot analysis of what's happening, the complexity level rises enormously, and the portability of the equipment decreases in inverse proportion. Sound for film can be recorded on a machine such as the Nagra portable tape recorder, which puts a sync pulse on the tape that corresponds to the motion of the sprocket holes of the film running through the camera. Back at base, when the film has been processed, the sound is transferred to magnetic film with the same dimensions as the picture film, and the two are cut and rejoined in corresponding places. This, as you might gather, is an equipment, time, labour-intensive procedure, ripe for the introduction of more modern ways of doing things. When video equipment was first introduced to news teams, two time-consuming stages of the process were immediately done away with. Videotape doesn't need to be processed and only needs to be rewound before it can be viewed. Sound can be recorded directly onto the soundtracks of the videotape and is therefore automatically synchronized to the picture. Of course, sound can be recorded and handled separately to some advantage, but speed is of the essence in ENG. Editing can start as soon as a videotape arrives in the editing suite, and the tape can be made ready for broadcast very quickly. In the early days of portable video equipment, a camera would be linked by cable to a smallish U-matic video recorder slung uncomfortably over the shoulder. Although portable U-matics were the mainstay of ENG for several years, I'm going to bypass this transitional phase and move on to the main item of current interest, the camcorder. As everyone south of Siberia knows by now, a camcorder is a video camera with an integral video recorder. The domestic models are great for shooting the kids, and the professional versions are great for shooting news, and even the domestic models find their role when cameramen would really prefer to be taken for tourists. Camcorders can also, I am told, be gainfully employed in television drama, where a mobile handheld camera can go virtually anywhere in the action without trailing a cable behind. Sony's greatest contribution to ENG was Betacam. Betacam is really a two-part concept, the first being the idea of having a one-piece camera and recorder, often presented as two units which dock together, the second being the on-tape format of the video itself. Betacam is based on the domestic Betamax cassette tape, remember those? But the video is recorded onto the tape in a completely different way, so don't get the idea that Betacam is an uprated version of the domestic system. It isn't, it just uses the same size tape. The original Betacam, non-SP, could in fact use a standard Betamax cassette, although more highly graded tapes were preferred, so a cameraman could stand a reasonable chance of buying emergency supplies at a Timbuktu hi-fi and video emporium. Well, he could a few years ago, before Betamax died an unjustified death. Whereas a Betamax cassette could record epic-length films off-air, the maximum running time of a standard Betacam tape is a little over 36 minutes. This is due to a much higher tape speed, 10.15 centimetres per second. The tape width is approximately half an inch, as opposed to the 3/4 inch format of U-matic, and 1 inch of C format. I should mention at this point that Betacam wasn't the only camcorder that was developed in the early years. There were others, such as the RCA Hawkeye, which uses the ChromaTrack system to record onto VHS cassettes. Betacam SP is a development of the original Betacam format, which allows for full broadcast quality pictures. The principal difference between Betacam and scene format or U-matic is that Betacam records component rather than composite video. The complete video signal consists of a luminance signal, which represents the brightness of the image, and two chrominance signals, which describe the colour. These are encoded for transmission into a single NTSC or PAL signal, which is decoded at the receiver back into the individual components. A C-format recorder writes the composite video signal directly to the tape, using frequency modulation. The U-matic system strips out the chrominance from the composite signal and modulates it onto a lower frequency FM carrier before recording. This is known as colour under. Converting from component to composite and back again is a bit like mixing together a bag of sand and a bag of sugar, and then sorting out the grains. Difficult, possible perhaps, but unlikely to be achieved with anything like perfection. A video camera generates component signals, so it's a perfectly reasonable argument to say that the picture should remain in component form all the way through the editing and mixing phases, right up until the last moment before transmission. This used to entail extra cabling in the studio for the red, green and blue signals, but let's leave that part of the story for another day. Betacam may not be the format of the future, since digital video will eventually sweep everything else under the carpet. But right now, Betacam can be considered to be future-friendly, to coin a phrase. The latest thinking in video circles is that the way to go is into component recording and signal handling. The advantages over composite working, where the image is comprised by NTSC or PAL limitations right from the start, are many, and the cost disadvantages of components will be ameliorated by developments such as Sony's serial digital interface, which can transmit component pictures over distances up to 300 meters using a single coaxial cable. SDI, serial digital interface, is compatible with analog machinery such as recorders and monitors when they are suitably adapted. In fact, Betacam units are now available with integral SDI inputs and outputs. As a medium of acquisition, the Betacam component recording format transfers directly to any component medium, such as the digital D1 format, without any composite video compromises. So it would seem to be good for several years yet, at least. That article by David Meller in Audio Media.
It's Sparks on Radio Fax 6205 and 12255, presented by Andy Burnham, that's me, and Trevor Brook. And now a lovely technical article about op-amps. Digital 1.2 micron process yields CMOS op-amp with gain bandwidth of 800 MHz. Op-amps built on typical analog CMOS processes with 3 micron and larger geometries are known for low bias and quiescent currents, not for speed and bandwidth. However, fine-line digital CMOS processes can now offer both speed and bandwidth. For example, the cutoff frequency of an N-channel MOSFET fabricated on a 1.2 micron digital process can run between 3.5 and 4 GHz. As a result, some IC designers are now investigating the potential of putting a few wideband analog circuits on a high-speed digital CMOS chip. Many CMOS op-amps employ what is called a folded cascode architecture in a fully differential configuration for optimal gain and bandwidth. For stability, when running at a closed-loop gain of unity, the non-dominant pole of this circuit, or any op-amp, must be well beyond the desired bandwidth. This means that the circuit's transistors must have cut-off frequencies that are significantly higher than the pole's frequency. However, in this folded cascode circuit, the relatively large parasitic capacitance of the P-channel MOS transistors locates the pole at about 1 GHz. To move the pole to a higher frequency by eliminating the P-channel MOS devices from the high-frequency signal path, the designers bypassed the devices with a capacitive feed-forward path. The signal's high-frequency components are then amplified and passed to the outputs. At this point, they're mixed with the signal's low-frequency components. With a gate-to-source potential of 1.5 volts, the FTs of the MOSFETs are 4.7 GHz and the pole moves out to 1.7 GHz, the highest possible value from the fabrication process. While driving 50 ohms in parallel with 5 picofarads, the unity gain bandwidth of the op-amp runs to 800 megahertz, and the phase margin is 53 degrees. Open loop gain at DC is 39 decibels. Output swing running off plus or minus 2.5 volts is plus or minus 0.8 of a volt, and the offset voltage is 5 millivolts. Due to the low transconductance properties of MOS transistors relative to bipolar ones, the current required per transistor to get wide bandwidth is significantly greater. The amplifier's core dissipates 180 milliwatts of power, and the bias circuitry another 80 milliwatts, for a total current requirement of about 50 milliamps.
Music and Media reports the latest JICRA radio audience survey figures for radio listening in Great Britain. UK independent radio has increased its audience share to 36.4% in the April to June survey. And although all radio listening fell back 3% from the record levels in the first quarter of 1991, boosted by the Gulf War factor, independent radio listening fell only 1%, and its reach increased slightly to 53%. With a record weekly audience of 22.7 million, independent radio listening is now 12.6% higher than a year ago. The expansion in independent services has been reflected in increased audience levels. The figures are independent radio 36.4%, radio 1 24%, radio 2 13.7%, radio 3 1.6%, radio 4 10%, radio 5 1%, BBC local radio 8%, and other stations 5.3%. Radio 4 and Radio 3 registered the steepest declines. Radio 1 was the only BBC network to show a gain, helped by the introduction of its 24-hour service and a noticeable increase in weekend listening. The station now attracts 6.8 million listeners daily. Capital Radio continues to dominate the highly competitive London radio market, despite increases in reach by KISS, Melody and Jazz. Capital FM holds the largest audience share of the London market at nearly 16%, ahead of BBC Radio 2 at 14% and Radio 1 with 13%. Capital Gold on AM has 9% share. Independent radio listening was up, with Beacon, GWR, Radio 4th and Cool FM achieving the largest increases in figures. However, there were some falls, with Clyde, County Sound, Invictor FM, Essex, Mid Anglia, Devonair, Plymouth Sound and Mercury all falling in reach by 4% or more. And just to finish, let's pick out a couple of incremental stations from the table here. First, there's KCBC, which is ex-Caroline Crispin St John or Howard Rose's station in Kettering and Corby, with a 23% reach, while Mellow 1557, transmitting from Clacton and using studios in Frinton-on-Sea of one-time laser owner Ray Anderson, East Anglia Productions, the whole station now owned these days by Invicta from Kent, at 11%.
Can't get to sleep. I think about the implications of diving in too deep, and possibly the complications, especially at night. I worry over situations. No, we'll be alright. Perhaps it's just imagination. Day after day it reappears. Night after night my heartbeat shows the fear. Ghosts appear and fade away. I know between the sheets only brings exasperation. It's time to walk the streets, smell the desperation. At least there's pretty lights. Though there's little variation, it nullifies the night from overkill. Day after day we appear. Night after night my heartbeat shows the fear. Ghosts appear and fade away. Come back another day.
Here's a letter from a man with a very ostentatious signature, Mr. Brian Cleary from Rosslare, County Wexford in Ayr. To all at the fabulous Radio Facts, just a small note from a dedicated 6205 listener to say well done and keep it up. The format is absolutely magnificent. I especially like the information about the pirates. There is a flourishing shortwave pirate scene in Ireland at the moment, with a new pirate, Diamond Hits International, to open soon here in Wexford. But it's a rumour at the moment, a very strong one at that. Enjoy yourselves and keep the good sounds going. Thanks, Brian. Well, we'd love to have your letters, and as the man mentions, at Sparks we're running a radio pirate sort of listing. Write in and give me frequencies of AM, FM, shortwave pirates in your area, and I'll mention them for everybody to listen out for. The address is Sparks, Radio Fax, The Forge, Cranley, England, GU6 7BG. If you'd like a reply to your letter, which includes a station card, technical information and an artist's impression of the transmitter site, please send 50 pence, 3 international reply coupons or $1 to Sparks, Radio Fax, The Forge, Cranley, England, GU6 7BG. Here's an article from Electronics Weekly. Optical channels kill off aerials. All the residents of a medium-sized town could watch TV from the same aerial using fibre-optic technology demonstrated by GEC Marconi at Caswell recently. The Subscriber Coherent Multi-Channel, that's CMC, system, developed under the RACE project, should be ready for commercial exploitation by the end of next year. The Marconi Group chose to demonstrate 10 channels of video being distributed to 1,000 subscribers at 3 different sites 10.6 kilometres apart. According to Brian Debney, the project's manager, this setup was chosen to demonstrate the technology, and the number of channels and subscribers and the separation could all be increased. Lord Hesketh, Minister of State at the DTI, attended the demonstration. If the project succeeds, it will do away with all those nasty TV aerials and satellite dishes, he said. The RACE chairman, Mr. Condaris, said the technology should satisfy the needs of multimedia communication for the year 2000. The purpose of the project is to act as a stepping stone for integrated IT networks for the next century, he said. The CMC system has been developed by a consortium of companies consisting of Philips, Siemens, GPT, the Heinrich Hertz Institute in Berlin, and IMEC at the University of Ghent.
Yesterday don't matter, 'cause it's gone. While the sun is bright or in the darkest night, no one knows. She comes and then she goes. Lost, but such a cost. goodbye, Ruby Tuesday, goodbye, Ruby Tuesday, goodbye.
Now here's a couple of items from Radio Netherlands Media Network.
It looks like the Luxembourg government's going to divide up its frequencies to the highest bidder at the start of next year. However, that'll only apply to the four national FM frequencies and another 40 FM channels for low-power local operations. CLT, the company which runs Radio Luxembourg, retains its hold on the high-power medium-wave channel of 1440 kHz and also the shortwave frequencies. Radio Fax, operating two transmitters from the Irish Republic, has changed its format and now on Mondays has started programming science and technology news instead of music. The channel of 6205 kHz runs 24 hours a day with 1 kilowatt, whilst 12255 kHz operates round the clock with 200 watts.
I've got the strange feeling I've heard about that station somewhere, Andy.
Well, thanks very much, Jonathan, for that much-appreciated plug. This is Sparks from Radio Fax every Monday and Tuesday, and fresh programmes start, other than us, on Wednesdays, Fridays and Sundays.
Five. Japanese AM stations will go stereo by Alan Carter in Tokyo in Radio World. The effect of Japan selecting an AM stereo standard on the further acceptance of the system and on the production of receivers is yet to be determined, but the action can be nothing but a benefit. The Japanese Ministry of Post and Telecommunications has endorsed Motorola CQAM as the AM stereo standard in Japan. Approximately 50 AM stations in Japan are expected to begin broadcasting in stereo during the next year. CQAM, developed by Motorola, was selected after an exhaustive study among five transmission systems. Also evaluated were ISB, developed by Leonard Kahn of New York, AM/PM from Magnavox, CPM by Harris, and AM/FM, developed by Bellar. Officials in Japan said they selected a single standard for the economy of not having to deal with multiple standards. "We are delighted," said Frank Hilbert, manager of the Modulation System Laboratory at Motorola in the United States. "This is a breakthrough as far as radio is concerned. Japan should lead the way for other countries in the lucrative Pacific Rim radio market to go stereo on AM. Other countries using CQAM are Mexico, Brazil, Canada, and Australia. Yet the United States, the world's number one buyer of radios, does not have an AM stereo standard after the United States Federal Communications Commission refused to set one after years of wrangling between Motorola and Leonard Kahn. The FCC, however, is considering a provision that would require stations to broadcast in stereo without selecting a single standard. Motorola considers CQAM the de facto standard in the United States because the company said that of just less than 700 AM stations broadcasting in stereo in the United States, only 24 to 30 use the independent sideband method of Leonard Kahn. According to Yasuo Suzuki, Counselor for Economic Affairs at the Japanese Embassy in Washington, Japan's receiver manufacturers do not base production decisions fully on export potential, but also on demand within their own country. "The Japanese listener is eager to hear stereo," Suzuki said, "and the broadcasters want to improve their quality of broadcasting. This latest boost for AM stereo comes as the radio world develops the next generation of radio broadcasting, digital audio broadcasting. DAB would change radio as it is known today, creating a new transmission standard and requiring new receivers. But many believe DAB will not be a setback for AM. I don't think any AM improvement is rendered moot because of DAB," said Michael Rao, Senior Vice President of Science and Technology at the US National Association of Broadcasters. "DAB remains a promise, and AM radio exists today and has to be dealt with." Hilbert said he believed DAB had been oversold, and he questions its implementation with the current debate over spectrum and far diverse differences in transmission techniques. "Anybody who's waiting for DAB is waiting for magic of some kind," Hilbert said. "That's my personal opinion." That article about broadcasting stereo on medium wave was from Radio World. And we notice that the new technical specifications for AM transmission from the Radio Authority specifically exclude phase modulation. That's not a stipulation which we recall being in the previous IBA regulations. So there'll be no stereo broadcasting on AM in Great Britain unless there are special dispensations made.
15 years of Radio Jackie. This LP record traces the story from early operations in fields through High Street Studios to the final close down.
Police with tracker dogs and post office detection men raided a pirate radio station in South London yesterday. Radio Jackie, which was said to broadcast for 6 hours every Sunday afternoon, was manned by about 15...
On March the 7th, 1972, Radio Jackie made parliamentary history when a tape of the station was played to a committee of the House of Commons during a debate on the Sound Broadcasting Bill. This tape, the first ever to be played in the House, was used to illustrate how commercial radio could sound if it were legalised in Great Britain.
Radio Jackie.
Jackie. Jackie.
The station that fits snugly into your ear.
Radio Jackie. The sound of Southwest London. Radio Jackie. The sound of Southwest London.
This is Channel 4.
A new crackdown on pirate radio by the Independent Broadcasting Authority. But is the IBA acting in the public interest?
This is Angela Rumbold, Member of Parliament for Mitcham and Morden. As many of you will know who are regular listeners to Radio Jackie, the government has introduced legislation recently which may put Radio Jackie's future at jeopardy.
From the bustle of suburbia to the rolling Surrey Downs.
From houseboats on the River Thames to office blocks in town. Close enough to really care as great should always be. We're Southwest London's favourite station. Radio Jackie.
In the last 16 years, I mean, Radio Jackie's done nothing but good, and the events leading to its closure are monstrous.
These fascinating recordings with a booklet of photographs all about Radio Jackie are yours for £6. For Europe, it's £8. And with airmail to the rest of the world, £10. Order your copy now from Radio Jackie, 120 London Road, Morden, England, SM4 5AT. A 30-year retrospective of the technical side of stereo broadcasting by Daniel von Recklinghausen in the Journal of the Audio Engineering Society. The first stereo FM broadcasts were made in the United States on the 1st of June 1961. Preceding that, six systems had undergone field tests the previous summer. Using the transmitter and antenna of the Westinghouse Broadcasting Station, KDKA, in Pittsburgh, at 92.9 megahertz. The test was conducted under the auspices of the National Stereophonic Radio Committee, NSRC. The reception site was in a motel in Uniontown, some 50 miles south of the transmitter, over hilly terrain. Tests were made in a one-week period in late July 1960. Each proponent was allotted use of the transmitter for testing during his day for an experimental period from 1 a.m. to 5 a.m. The detector of a Scott 310C provided the composite baseband output signal for the stereo demodulator of the tested system. Test equipment was pooled and sometimes borrowed from Norman Parker of Motorola. Parker brought his own receivers and antenna to monitor the tests in Uniontown in a panel truck. The company whose system was tested provided the 10-watt RF output to the transmitter, modulated with a composite signal, the stereo demodulator, and the refreshments for the attending representatives of all the proponents, the NSRC and the FCC. I then sampled Iron City beer for the first time. The sessions checked not only the systems, but also the stamina of the engineers. I missed the first few days of repeatedly rescheduled testing and arrived at the receiver test site just after returning from my honeymoon. Field tests began after nearly 2 years of submitting proposals, committee meetings, laboratory tests, and generating mountains of paper. Of the original 14 systems, only six survived to undergo NSRC field test. This eliminated all systems which sought to broadcast stereophonic audio signals over AM or television stations. Prior to that time,
FM stations were permitted to broadcast background music and other signals. Since 1955, they used the baseband spectrum space above the audio band, a process which took 5 years from petition to the time the FCC changed the broadcast rules. Stereophonic broadcasts were occasionally heard in the United States in the late 1950s. At first, two broadcast stations were needed, one for the left channel and the other for the right side. Later, the FM station of a licensee typically broadcast to the left channel signal, and the AM station transmitted the right channel with reduced reception quality. Long-playing stereo records in existence since 1957, along with reel-to-reel tapes and a few live performances, were the source of entertainment. A favourite stereo demonstration came from Capitol Records, featuring a loud, raspy-voiced girl in a bowling alley. The sound of a bowling ball moving between the loudspeakers was the first introduction to stereo sound for many people. The use of one carrier frequency to support multiple signals modulating a single carrier frequency became known as multiplexing. Multiplex stereo became the order of the day. Every FM tuner had to have a multiplex output jack, somehow coupled to the FM detector. My employer, Scott, was not immune from this pressure. We too had a multiplex jack, coupled with a 5 nanofarad capacitor to the detector. The thinking was that only frequency components above the audio range were needed by the undefined multiplex adapter. This turned out to be a mistake. After the FCC announcement, all multiplex adapters sold required an input resistance in excess of 100 megohms, achieved by negative feedback. A more serious mistake was to have an area on the tuner chassis marked as reserved for a future multiplex stereo adapter. The ultimate adapter designed for all Scott tuners did not fit in the marked space, and there was no available plate and filament voltage capacity or connection space. Fortunately, the other suppliers of high-fidelity audio equipment made worse mistakes. 30 years ago, practically all consumer electronics equipment used vacuum tubes. Although the transistor had been invented 12 years earlier, only a few types of germanium small signal transistors could be bought at a high price. Junction and point contact germanium diodes were in common use, many of them produced by Raytheon. Selenium rectifiers and vacuum rectifiers supplied direct voltages of tens and hundreds of volts for receivers. During the next few years, while the technology was changing to solid-state designs, there were many growing pains. All of the proposed stereo broadcasting systems were analog systems. Digital coding was in its infancy. Stereophonic broadcast signals had to be such that an existing FM radio could receive the monophonic portion of the broadcast with minimum degradation in quality. The result was that the audio frequency portion of the signal in the main channel ended up being the sum of the left and right program channels. The same restriction meant that only a small portion of the available peak frequency deviation of 75 kHz could be used for a subcarrier or a pilot carrier, with the remainder being the monophonic portion of the signal. All systems except one required a peak amplitude reduction of about 10% for their subcarrier. One of the disadvantages of the Crosby Teletronic system was its need for 50% amplitude reduction to accommodate its frequency modulated subcarrier. The systems proposed by the General Electric Company and Zenith Radio Corporation used the main channel for the sum signal of the left and right. The different signal modulated a subcarrier in amplitude with suppression of the subcarrier. In essence, the two input channels were sampled at the subcarrier rate. A pilot carrier at one-half the subcarrier frequency caused the two demodulated channels to remain in the same phase relationship. From a listening standpoint, the system proposed by EMI was a special case. The left and right program channels were combined at the transmitter into a monophonic sum channel. The difference signal was converted into a steering signal at a supra-audible frequency, which caused varying proportions of the main channel signal to be directed to the two audio output channels in the receiver. The disagreeable effect was that a loud vocalist off to one side would temporarily pull the whole orchestra into the vocalist's position. An important consideration was that the stereo broadcasting service would not cause any more interference to other stations than the existing mono broadcast service. At that time, it meant that no baseband modulation frequency components could be above the 75 kHz limit imposed by the maximum peak deviation. All systems tested met this restriction. As we all know, the FCC chose the Zenith GE system. One of the secrets of success is to make few minor mistakes compared to your competition. In this sense, we were successful. The 15 kHz low-pass filters in the audio output lines served to avoid beat notes between the bias oscillator of a tape recorder and the regenerated stereo subcarrier when trying to record a stereo program. Another filter in the composite signal line attenuated the background music carrier sufficiently to avoid intermodulation noise in the stereo output signal. It was a mistake not to have a stereo light in the first model to indicate the presence of a pilot carrier when the listener tuned in a stereo broadcast. An audible indicator, the stereo beep, was tried instead, but greeted with apathy. Soon after, a light was used, operated by an automatic switch, which activated the stereo decoding circuitry. In 1957, many FM stations had gone off the air. Only about 500 remained in the United States. The establishment of the Subsidiary Communications Authorization, SCA, allowing broadcasters to transmit background music signals on a subcarrier, caused broadcasters to return to FM. By 1961, over 1,000 FM stations were on the air, many of them dependent on the additional SCA income. The quality of FM tuners and receivers improved over this period, and FM reception quality became comparable to the ever-improving stereo records. The shift to stereo broadcasting in 1961 caused an increase in the number of FM stations. A further boost to FM popularity was the mid-1960s change in FCC rules to broadcast the same power with vertical antenna polarization in addition to the power previously authorized for horizontal polarization only, in effect doubling the station's radiated power. More important, FM signals could now be received in automobiles using their vertical whip antennas. 10 years after the stereo decision, there were over 2,600 FM stations on the air in the US. The same FM broadcasting standard had become a worldwide standard. It is now difficult to think of FM broadcasts not in stereo. Parts of an article there by Daniel von Recklinghausen.